Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. I am Justice Bill Meyer, and I'll be presiding judge for these oral arguments. If counsel is ready, would you please call the cases?
The court will now call Crescent SWD Services LP and DJ Corp versus Basic Energy Services LP.
Afternoon,
sir. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm Richard Ward. I'm counsel for the appellant Crescent, along with Mr. Boone, my co-counsel. This is an appeal from a jury verdict in a case that was a breach of contract case, but probably ended up having a lot of implications of negligence tried. Probably not so. I think that may have led to some of the jury confusion. We think the issues are fairly simple. There is a appeal and statement of issue for an abuse of discretion by the trial judge for denial of a motion for new trial at the conclusion of the jury verdict. The jury was given four questions, but they only got to questions one and two. And we contend that there is no evidence to support the jury's determination for their answers to either question one or question two. And as a result of that, their verdict, since there's no evidence, is prejudicial. It's against the preponderance of the evidence. And should be reversed by this court. Starting with, and I think the standard, while the standard is abuse of discretion for the denial of the motion for new trial, the standard is slightly different for the setting aside of the jury's verdict. I think at the end, we come to the same place, because our argument is that there's no evidence to support either of those, and in some instances, the only evidence in the record establishes the opposite of what the jury found. If you start, the court, after a challenge, directed a verdict, and this is not challenged before this court, that there was a contract. There was a dispute about whether there was a contract, but by the time it got to the jury, that issue had been determined for them and is not challenged by a cross appeal from the appellees. The question then became, what did the contract say? The appellee, and there were these things called daily work tickets that were executed by a man named Jerry Lack. I'll get to the test, get to what Mr. Lack's status was, but the starting point is Mr. Lack was hired by Crescent to be a consultant. The only testimony is that he was a consultant. There's no testimony in the record that anyone at Crescent, or Mr. Lack even, held himself out as anything other than a consultant. There are a bunch of arguments in both briefs that we addressed in anticipation in case the jury tried to find that Mr. Lack had somehow been an agent, because we don't think, as we'll show, that, and as the brief show, that there is any evidence that Mr. Lack was the agent under the applicable standards. But the first thing that the jury was charged with was looking at what were called daily work tickets. Now, those weren't, the contract that the court found was already in place. Daily work tickets, the evidence establishes, were signed at the end of each day by Mr. Lack. If you look, and there was a daily work ticket that was actually redacted for the specific numbers for who worked, what hours, and things like that. It has two sides. Front side, if you look, which is Appendix 4, has essentially very little on it. There's almost nothing. The back side, in a number of printed terms, has a number of paragraphs, 1, C, D, E, and G, I believe, which are risk-shifting provisions. Those provisions basically attempt to create indemnifications in favor of Basic, things that would allow Basic to claim that Basic had not violated the contract. The jury received a specific charge from the court with respect to an issue that probably is a legal issue, but the parties fought about that on motions for summary judgment. We fought about it on motions in limine, and it had been overruled, and the court was going to put it in front of the jury. The jury got an argument that for them to look at the terms on the backside of the document, or instruction, excuse me, for the jury to look at the terms on the backside of the document, the jury had to look only to the front side and see if there was something on the front side of the document that in any way, shape, or form referenced that there were risk-shifting allocation provisions on the backside. And if you look at the front of the document, there's just flat, there's nothing on it. There's nothing that's been cited by the appellees in their brief. There are very few words even on that page. but there is absolutely nothing that would allow a reasonable person to see that there are terms on the back and that those terms contain risk-shifting provisions. So under the fair notice requirements that are stated in Dresser versus Page, our contention is that there is no evidence in front of the jury following the instruction to find that the back of the contract came into play.
How do you address his assertion that you didn't plead it? You didn't plead the affirmative defense of fair notice to his affirmative defense.
Well, it was pled, and it was raised in the motions for summary judgment, if you want to take that argument. The Dresser court specifically addressed the same issue in Dresser and found that the matter having been raised at trial, since it was technically probably a legal argument, had been preserved for error by virtue of all the motions for summary judgment. And we have the exact quote of that language from the Dresser case in our reply brief. So I think that addresses and overcomes any argument that it may not have been specifically pled, because it was, and it was argued a number of times. I personally think that the issue, that the trial court made a mistake, that it was a legal issue, but the Dresser ruling also basically says that whether it was a legal issue or not, the error would have been preserved by virtue of all the summary judgment arguments. It can be addressed by this court. Our argument, however, is not that as a matter of law they made a mistake. The argument is that the jury just flat didn't follow the instructions. If they'd followed the instructions, there's no way that they could have answered yes to question one, because answering yes allowed them to go to the back of the document, and doing that required them to see something on the front of the document that would refer them to the back of the document.
Since the answer to the second question was not conditioned in any way on any specific answer to the first question, and in the second question, the jury found that the appellee did not fail to comply with the agreement, what difference does it make as to what the answer to the first question is?
Well, if you look, and the argument that we make is that there is no evidence whatsoever of compliance. The only evidence of the contract is that there was an agreement to deepen the well to 8,600 feet to set a line or approximately 1,000 feet above that. The only evidence, which is testified to by Mr. Barter and all of the and Mr. Thomas, who are the testifying witnesses that were involved after the contract was formed for BASIC, admit that they knew that the contract was to deepen the well to 8,600 feet. The evidence is unrefuted that the well did not make it to 8,600 feet. Now, in one of their appellee's brief, BASIC says, well, we didn't do anything wrong, but this isn't a negligence lawsuit. It's not a breach of warranty lawsuit. It's a contract lawsuit, and the contract and the only evidence of the contract in the record at all is that there was an agreement to deepen the well to 8,600 feet.
But didn't your client tell him to stop because of the issues of the whip, whatever that is?
Whip stock?
And not that you didn't want to spend any more money on this?
No, actually, we never told them. There's nothing in the record that there was to be no more money spent. What was in the record was that there was a meeting. And at the meeting, it was presented basically by the BASIC employees of the problems that were there, and things needed to be considered before deciding whether anything would be done, so the well was released from the property. But the well was never, there's nothing in the record that ever says, BASIC never says that anyone from Crescent said, your contract is terminated. You don't have to work anymore. We don't want you on our property. BASIC never tried to come back, and the only thing in the record is that after the well came off, BASIC started calling Crescent demanding payment for the services that had been performed.
Well, I thought that the record reflected that LAC said that it was going to cost another $200,000 to get around the fact that to locate the window. And at that point, y'all decided we're not going to spend any more money on the well.
No, LAC said that, Your Honor, but I don't think that's right, because the testimony is clear that Crescent was willing to spend, as long as the deal was, which was argued, was that payment would not be in cash, but that BASIC would do the work in exchange for being able to use water that they would inject through their water hauling and injection services, that Crescent and Mr. Pulling testified this well was making somewhere around $80,000 to $100,000 a month before the problem arose with Devon that required the rework that went bad. His testimony was, even if it cost him another $600,000 or $700,000, at the end of 7 months, he would have been back to a well that was making $100,000 a month for the partners of Crescent. So I don't think there's anything that says that the amount of the cost was a cause for them to...
Well, here's what the brief says. Lack advised appellants that it would cost at least $200,000 to determine where the bore window was due to the unexpected whipstock having been removed. The next day, Lack advised Thomas that Basic should remove the rig because the Crescent Well project was being abandoned. I'm on page 10 of the appellee's brief. So you just say that's wrong.
And I don't, I don't think that there's a citation. I don't think you can find the word abandonment or we're not going to ever proceed with the project anywhere right there. So I think that's one of the issues that we have with some of the factual positions that were taken. I think that our brief is better cited to the portions of the appellate record and actual testimony, and theirs is based on statements of what they were called.
Well, we'll see what it says what it says.
Well, once you told him to stop, did you ever tell him to come back? Okay, we've decided we want to go on?
No, Your Honor, because before that, they told us they demanded payment for something when they didn't have time to demand for payment. So the question is, they were never told by us that they didn't have to deepen the well to 8,600 feet, ever. And the problem that we've got, and the problem that I have, as we pointed out in our reply brief, there was never an issue placed in front of the jury about whether or not there was some kind of excuse or they were released from performance under the obligation, which I believe would be an affirmative defense that it wasn't pled by Basic at any point. It wasn't in the trial court. It wasn't in the instructions to the jury. So I don't think it's an issue that would be before the court at this time.
I'm going to go back to my original question then. If this court were to find that there was sufficient evidence to support the jury's finding that Basic did not fail to comply with the agreement, what difference does it make what the answer to question number one was?
Well, I think, Your Honor, under Rule 44.1 and under the Romeo versus KPH consolidation case that we cited, I don't think you can necessarily get there. Because just because there's some evidence that might say that, the way I read Romeo versus KHP, if there's a reasonable certainty that the mistake could have been used by the jury to cause them to significantly consider it in their determination, Rule 44 says that the mistake on question one by adding these terms to the contract requires that the case go back. Essentially, because if you look at all of those terms, if the back sheet of the contract comes in, Basic wins. We wouldn't have had a lawsuit if that had been determined on a summary judgment motion or at some point earlier in the process. There's no basis for us to have a claim because all of those terms and conditions give them indemnifications. And I think their appellee brief says, well, we really didn't assert the indemnification, so the fair notice rule doesn't apply, which really doesn't make much sense to me. But if you look at those, they've got something that absolves them from any damage to the well bore, absolves them for personal injury, absolves them for anything that happens on the property. Basically, we couldn't have asserted a claim against them whatsoever. The problem with the case that makes this unusual is, for some reason, Basic did this, and I don't know why, but it doesn't matter at this point. But Basic went out there and did this work on essentially an oral contract, thought about whether there was a contract for a long time, even though they had a crew out there working. They're going, we didn't have any contracts, which begs the question of how would the rig ever gotten on the property without a contract?
Okay, let's back up for a minute. I think I understand what you're saying is, because question two ends with failed to comply with the agreement, the question is, what is the agreement? And if they answered question number one, yes, then they considered the agreement to be the front and the back side of the ticket. If they answered no, they would have decided that only the front side of the ticket was the agreement. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's part of what I'm saying. Yes, on that argument, you're correct, Your Honor. But then we go beyond that to say that we think the only evidence is the deepening of the well to the 8,600 feet, and they didn't comply. So if the court were to find that our argument on Rule 44 and the Romero case is not applicable to the mistake that the jury made with respect to the answer to question one, so you can look at two independently, we think that even an independent look at two leaves you with a breach of contract, because the contract was get to 8,600 feet. They didn't do it.
Well, if the agreement includes, I mean, I believe you just admitted a minute ago, if the agreement includes what's on the back side of the ticket, you lose.
I agree, Your Honor.
And if it doesn't, that's a different situation.
I concur with that. But as we stated, if you look at Dresser and all the applicable case law, there's just flat no basis for the jury to have made a finding that they could look to the backside of the contract.
That's a different argument. I got you.
Yes, sir. Now, there are a bunch of arguments, and I'm running a little short on time, about Mr. Lack on authority. We briefed the issue. There's no actual authority for Mr. Lack, because Mr. Lack's undisputed testimony is that he didn't know the terms of the contract, couldn't modify it.
Well, let's read what he said, and then let's see if you dispute this or what you do with it. He says, I have, and I'm sure you've read this, I may have read this, and he's talking about the back of the ticket. The back of these tickets twice or three times in the last 30 years. I've done this because you start getting into legal terms. All I know is that I have authority to do, all I have authority to do is to prove the work that day. And then he says, wasn't what you were agreeing to, that was part of the agreement between Basic and Crescent? I mean, I was agreeing to the work here. And then he talks about if the terms and conditions, this is a contractual thing, and this is a contract. So, I mean, their position is, he says that he knows this thing we're talking about is a contract, and he says, I don't know that he comes out and says, I know what's on the back, but he says he's read the terms and conditions. So
I think his testimony was he read the terms and conditions on some contracts like that.
Well, I just read what he said.
Yes, sir, exactly. But I think if you go back to the more of his testimony around that point, he says that he's aware that there are terms and conditions, and he may have read some of them over 30 years, but I think his testimony is, if you go farther, that he did not specifically read the backs of these contracts. But even if Mr. Lack read them, the testimony is undisputed. He never conveyed the fact that he'd read those terms, that they were there, to anyone on behalf of Crescent. And since there's no... You can't prove agency through the actions and statements of the agent, which Mr. Lack is the purported agent.
Okay, I've got you. I've run over your
Mr.
time.
Ward, I'm sorry to keep you, but I do have a question that I'm interested in your response to, and we'll extend the time for your opponent. You made the statement when you started that the trial court had determined by summary judgment rulings in earlier proceedings that there was a contract between the parties. Did I hear you right on that?
If you did, I misspoke. The trial court determined at trial and issued an instructed verdict to the jury. It had been contested all the way up through trial, and during trial, the trial court concluded that there was no factual issue, that there had been a contract to rework the property.
All right. Now, at that point, that'll be in the transcript dealing with the rulings of the trial court on a motion, I take it, or did he do that on his own?
I'm trying to remember.
That's
if
okay.
It was,
but as long as it's in the record, we'll find it. But here's my question. That was just the buildup to the question. The question is, what were the terms of the contract that the trial court decided was in place?
Trial court decided, instructed the jury only that the well was to be reworked. And that's why we went through and made sure that we pointed out that the record established that the contract was to deepen the well to 8,600 feet, and pointed the court to citations of testimony of not just the witnesses of Crescent, but the witnesses of Basin, Mr. Barter and Mr. Thomas, that they both knew that the well was to be deepened to 8,600 feet.
And the 1,000-foot
liner.
Liner put in. However, I didn't see in the briefs that a direct reference to whether any of those parties at trial testified as to the way in which Basic was to be paid was to allow credits in the future for saltwater infusion.
Well, I think the only evidence, Your Honor, of any kind of agreement would be that. Now, Mr. Boren may have testified that no, he never would have done that, but Mr. Boren also testified that he never would have worked without the approval of a credit application, and the record reflects in one of the exhibits that the credit application that was submitted by Crescent was rejected by Basic about 3 days after November 5th.
All right. So is it your position that the aspect of what is referred to by all parties as an oral contract, that part of those terms were the method of payment that was to be delivered to Basic for the deepening of the well and the liner?
Yes.
And so your contention is that the agreement between BASIC and the other party was strictly that you deepen the well to 8,600 feet, you put a 1,000-foot liner in it, and you get paid for that by using the well in the future as saltwater injections and getting credits against your cost.
That's our contention, but I'm not sure that, I don't believe, Your Honor, that the cost and the payment method of it is really relevant at this time, because BASIC, as a result of some complicated actions involving the bankruptcy court, was not allowed to plead as a defense that they weren't paid.
Well, it's relevant in one sense in my mind, and that is that when it is contended on the part of BASIC that they never agreed to complete the project. If they didn't agree to complete the project and they were only to be paid if it was completed and future saltwater injections could be made, then that's a little inconsistent.
I'm not sure I understand.
Well, if the only way the BASIC would get paid is future use of the well, okay?
Correct.
And if the requirements from the Railroad Commission, as well as the requirements of the settlement, were to deepen the well to 8,600 feet or 7,600 something bottom, whatever the ending number is there, and if the well is never completed to that depth, then it can't be used for saltwater injections, and therefore there's not going to be any way to pay for the agreement to do the rework.
Well, Your Honor, the problem with that goes to BASIC not completing the work. And the testimony from Mr. Thomas that we pointed out is the problem was the well could have been deepened to 8,600 feet. BASIC just didn't have the right equipment to do it and didn't want to go out and get the equipment.
Yes, I read that, and I understand that's part of what I'm getting to, but I'm just having a difficult time understanding a dual argument that you're going to get paid by future use. You can only get paid by future use if the well's completed and it's approved in terms of the way it's been reworked by the Railroad Commission. And if that's not going to happen because you didn't do what you were required to do, you're just never going to get paid.
Well, Your Honor, that would ordinarily, if a party breaches a contract, they really don't have a right to expect to get paid for breach. I guess they could try a quantum merit theory, but there's no real quantum merit that was placed before the court or before the jury. So when BASIC didn't do the work that they were supposed to, they didn't have any expectation to get paid either through water delivery or through monetary means in an ordinary contractual situation.
Was there evidence presented as to the amount of work, the value of the work that was done before BASIC got off the job? In other words, what were they contending they were entitled to be paid when they demanded money payment?
I don't believe that there was, Your Honor, because I believe that was struck as a result of conditions
bankruptcy.
That the bankruptcy court placed on the withdrawal of the claim so that the liability portion of the case would not have been tried in bankruptcy
Thank
court.
Thank you, Mr. Ward. And let's allow Mr. Rutherford an additional 8 minutes. That's just how long it took, according to my watch, for us to talk with Mr. Ward there beyond his time.
So no quantum merit?
There was no quantum merit pled, Judge.
Okay.
And I apologize. I'm just making sure we're okay time-wise.
Got you.
May it please the court, my name is Brian Rutherford, and I represent the appellee. There were several questions asked. I'm going to try to take them as they came up. Judge Gabriel, you asked about why does conditioning matter. Our contention is that the way that this was submitted to the jury, because the plaintiffs, the appellants here, did not ask for conditioning language, they're stuck with the answer to question two. The answer to question two was, did my client fail to comply with an agreement to rework the well? The answer was no. The analysis stops there. If there were conditioning language of some sort, there might be an argument that the terms and conditions were included in whatever the agreement was, but because that conditioning language was not there, this court's analysis can stop at that point. So
we have to take into consideration that the jury found that the back of the ticket was a part of the contract and or the agreement that your client failed to comply with?
The short answer to that is for, I think the application of the terms and conditions is a legal application that the court makes, not a fact-finding issue that the jury makes. I think the jury might move on to address.
I'm not understanding your answer.
Yes, Your Honor.
I understood her question, but I'm not understanding your answer.
Okay.
If the jury found, if those last three words of the agreement, they need to know what the agreement is. And by their affirmative answer to the first question, it seems to me they're considering the agreement to be the front and the back of the ticket.
I would think, Judge, that it would go the other way around. And I know I'm going off point
okay,
a little
go ahead.
Bit to address
no,
the,
go ahead.
The question. But this ties into a question, how did this jury charge come to be? And there was a little bit of give and take. There were the issues about the directed verdict. And candidly, I think that these two questions are probably out of order, the way that they were submitted. The first question would be, did they fail to comply with the agreement? Okay, now what is the agreement? And that is an issue that the plaintiff should have submitted, should have objected to, should have addressed in some regard and did not.
We have both of those answers.
We do have the answers, but the answer is, what the jury is answering with question number one is, does the trial court, in giving effect to the jury's fact findings, do something with that as a matter of law? Do these terms and conditions on the back that the jury has said are there and were part of the agreement, do we give effect to that as a matter of law? Because then the trial court, in post verdict, in looking at whether to enter a judgment and what kind of judgment, if we had lost on question number two, if the jury had said, yes, we had failed to comply, then we might have a legal defense that's triggered by the terms and conditions, the indemnity provision. And that's not an issue for a jury to address. The factual question about, you know, did they agree to them? Were they there? Did Mr. Lack do something with that? All the things under broad form submission that taper down into that question number one, that's the question. And then, I'm sorry, Judge.
Just out of curiosity, what is it on the face of those work tickets that's conspicuous that then calls someone to look at the back of the ticket to determine the agreement?
I would have to concede that there's not on the face of the ticket. It's the actual knowledge of Mr. Lack. Mr. Lack was aware.
Strictly on, and I'm reading from the site in your, that you cited as
correct, Your Honor.
He had read it two or three times in 30 years. And that this is a contractual thing, this is a contract. He never says that he reads the terms and conditions. He never says he knows what the terms and conditions are, but you're hanging your hat just on the fact that he has read the back of the ticket twice or three times in the last 30 years.
Correct, Judge. I agree with that statement. That he is aware that these terms and conditions are there.
Whatever they may say.
Whatever they may say. And that knowledge is imputed to his principal, which we argue here is the appellant's. But, again, we don't need to get to that question. This court doesn't need to get to that factual analysis because of the jury's answer to question number two and because of the lack of conditioning language. There is ample legal and factually sufficient evidence for this jury to have found that my client, Basic, did not fail to comply with the agreement. And that comes back to opposing counsel is stating, you know, that the agreement is 8,500 feet, that the agreement is very specific things. I pulled up the testimony of, this is Mr. Siddiqui, and this is Reporter's Record 3 at page 96. Mr. Siddiqui testified that he told Basic's people the work involved drilling the injection zone from 6,620 feet down to 7,720 feet and setting a liner. So there's at least some question in their mind of what depth they were going to, what the scope of the rework was going to be. And it's undisputed that Basic made it to 7,100 feet, which is past the whipstock, down out into the formation outside the wellbore somewhere. And so if the question was, did we make it past 6,620 feet? Yes, we did. We went to at least 7,100 feet. And at that point, there are issues that come up. Mr. Lack identifies, what do we do with those issues? You know what? Let me get Basic out of the way. Let me get a wireline service out here. Let's find out what's going on in that wellbore. And now we're dealing with a situation where Basic has stepped aside. They are not performing the work. They're waiting to see what is it that Mr. Lack, the company man, needs us to do. So at that point, they have done their work. They have drilled down. They've identified a problem. Mr. Lack says, step aside. Let's see what the scope of the problem is. And then I believe, Judge Meyer, you had asked the question, well, what did the plaintiffs do? What did the appellants do? And I'm looking, excuse me, this is Reporter's Record 4, pages 66 to 68, and this goes to the $200,000 question. You know, Mr. Lack is out there saying, well, it's going to take $200,000 to figure out what to do next, guys. What do you want to do? And this is Mr. Siddiqui was asked questions about, well, what are you going to do when a well goes offline? You can shut it in for a while. You can look for additional money. The email, excuse me, I said Mr. Siddiqui, it's Mr. Pulling. The email that Mr. Pulling sent to Siddiqui the day after this critical meeting is, should we liquidate? Should we get out from under this thing? What should we do? And he says, no, I mean, we saw that we were looking to either raise the capital, to redo, put a new well bore in. We were just looking at all our options to pay the bills. If we had to liquidate or raise new capital or drill a new well bore. And he was asked, what are the options? Well, when Basic came to us and said, pay us some money, why didn't Crescent just sue Basic that day? And this is Mr. Pulling's response. Again, my history has been to try to do a business solution, if you will. Nobody benefits from litigation. You know, we tried to work out an agreement. Our goal, which, you know, down the road didn't fulfill, but we were hoping to commence Basic to drill the well bore under the same conditions we had under the rework, so there's no reason to make them mad. They wanted to wait and see what their options were. They tried to get more capital in, and then they were ultimately unsuccessful in getting more capital. But the interesting thing to me is the point at which he says this was our cash cow, this was our moneymaker. They decided, after they had made these hundreds of thousands of dollars, not to reinvest that $200,000 and see what they could do with the existing well and call Basic back in and say, okay, let's get going. We're putting our own money back in. Let's get this cash cow going again. They chose not to do that. And they get to do that. That's their business decision. But that's what the record reflects. The record reflects they had options. They could get additional investors. They could do any number of things, and Basic was on hold. Mr. Lack, the company man, said, hold on, let's do this, came back and told Dwayne Thomas, rig down, pull your crew out of here, we don't need you. The owners have decided not to invest the money, not to move forward at this time. One of the other factual issues that's in the briefs is, what value did they have in the well, the plaintiffs, the appellants, what value did they have? And you have to, I think, look at what it was the day they called Basic. They had a shut-in well. The Railroad Commission had shut them down because they were trespassing into Devon's Energy's area. And so the value of the well the day Basic pulled off of that and the value of the well the day they were called is exactly the same. They got a well that doesn't work that they're not allowed to use.
Well, basically, your position is that they stopped the work on the well and told you to leave. Hence, you couldn't complete your contract.
That's correct, Judge. In a nutshell, that's correct. And I think, Judge Meyer, you asked this question, what does the record show with respect to how the jury charge came to be and the discussions, and then what is essentially a directed verdict on the existence of a contract? That's actually not in the record. The jury came back to deliberate on a Saturday morning because the informal charge conference went on all of Friday afternoon. And one of the many things that is, again, not in the record, I've got to candidly say that, the trial judge is asking, well, y'all were out there doing something, and they wanted you out there doing something. So there has to have been some rework. And that's the genesis for how we ended up with this particular instruction.
Well,
again, not
well,
the record.
Well,
judge.
What question two says specifically is when we talk about instructions about what the judge did about finding a contract, it says you're instructed, first sentence in question two, you're instructed that defendant agreed with plaintiff to rework the Crescent well.
Correct.
Then over here in the definition and instructions, we're given direction to the jury about how to find an agreement and what it might be.
Right.
say as trial judge that I'm finding and you're instructed that the defendant agreed with plaintiff to rework the Crescent well, and that's saying there is a contract.
Correct. At that point in the lawsuit and the litigation going forward to submit to the jury, you're right, that's what the judge is ending up with. And then the question becomes, you know, what is the scope of the rework? And again, I think there's plenty of testimony from our side, from Basic side, it's to go out there and try to do what the client wants us to do, the client being Crescent. They want us to go in there, try to drill down to a certain range of depth, which again, the actual depth is not as black and white as the opponents would say, put in a liner and let them keep using this well. And, you know, of course, any business is going to want to comply with their customers' requests. But as Mr. Boren said over and over, nobody can guarantee a working well. Nobody knows for sure what's happening 7,100 feet down in the earth.
How do you reconcile the portion of the alleged, or not alleged, the determined to have existed oral agreement as to how you'd be paid?
Judge, the record is less clear than I would like in that regard. And candidly, it's an issue that we didn't develop much as we were moving into trial because of the bankruptcy court's ruling. I wish it were a little clearer, but I think we would have drawn relevant objections based on what the bankruptcy court did.
So let me ask you this.
Yes, sir.
In terms of the bankruptcy court, was Basic Energy Services a party to the bankruptcy?
Honestly, Judge, that was before my tenure on the case. I want to say that we had filed a notice as a creditor, but I don't know that for sure, and I don't know that
I'm
it appears in this appellate record.
I'm just looking for the reason why that Basic would be bound by the determinations made by the bankruptcy.
There is a specific order, and it is part of the appellate record, precluding us from asserting any claim in the state court lawsuit.
Thank you, sir.
All right, let me see if I've got the big picture of what we're doing here.
Yes, Your Honor.
Seems to me the first thing we do is we look at question two, the wording at the very end of which is important, failed to comply with the agreement. So your position is we didn't fail to comply because we were booted off the job. So the next question is, well, what was the agreement? So the agreement, we go to question number one, what is the agreement? Well, because the jury answered yes, they must believe it's the front and back side of the ticket. Then we have to go and decide, well, was there actually an agreement? And the agreement depends on whether Mr. Lack was the agent. And once we decide if there's an agent or not, was it by apparent or actual authority? And then depending on how we answer that question, then that goes to whether he had actual knowledge of what was on the back of the ticket.
Very close, Judge. I think we have an out, though, at question one. I don't think that we're bound, that the terms and conditions are the scope of the agreement, because nowhere in there does it say how many feet to drill to, how much payment is rendered, when it has to be completed. The terms and conditions overall address very basic stuff. It's insurance, it's permits, who's going to get those, who's going to transport equipment. It's a variety. I got it right here. It's a variety of things. It's like I said, insurance, safety.
I know that there are some important parts in the back of the ticket.
Correct. Absolutely the allocation of risk. And we've got it in bold all caps on there. But the question is this a contract all by itself? Is it the full scope of the agreement? No. The essential terms of how far to go down and what we're doing out there are not included. And that's where I would differ from what you stated, Judge.
So your position is that if we were to agree that there's not sufficient evidence to support the jury's finding in question number one, and therefore we look at the evidence based upon an oral agreement only, there's still going to be sufficient evidence to support the jury's answer to question number two.
Correct, Judge. That's
exactly. Is it because you were booted off the job? Or is there more to it? From your position?
From my position, it's because we were booted off the job and because we had performed work out there. We had done rework on that well.
But that would be...
We'd been out there for a
quantum
month.
Quantum merrill, it seems to me. We were booted off the job. We want to be paid. We painted half the house, so we want to be, not the whole house, we want to be paid for what we painted. Yeah, we breached the contract, but you got a half-painted house.
The only difference, Judge, I would argue with your example, is we don't know the how big the house is till we get there. And it's just because of the nature of the work. So, and again, I'd come back to Mr. Boren's testimony, is nobody in the oil field industry can guarantee you working well at the end of the day. And that's an absolute term that the appellants are saying over and over. They guaranteed us a 100% working well. Nobody can do that. Nobody can agree to that. And there's not any testimony from them to the contrary. And, Your Honors, very briefly on Mr. Lack, I've cited at length in the brief. We've argued that there's actual authority. Mr. Siddiqui advised others that Lack was, and I'm not going to do air quotes, but leading the effort, the go-to person, and the work supervisor on the job. The sites are Defense Exhibit 93, Reporters Record 3, 148, 153, as well as the one cited in the brief. And that's legally sufficient evidence. Factually sufficient evidence, we've got Dwayne Thomas, who said Siddiqui said Lack was Crescent's consultant, which Thomas understood as being the company man. There was no question in their mind that this is the guy. If you want to call Siddiqui, you got to go through Lack. If you got to tell him about a problem, you got to go through Lack. Basic is out there to operate this equipment at Lack's instruction. There's no dispute about that. He's the face. He's the company man. We've also argued apparent authority, and going back to my statement at the beginning, Lack knew what the terms and conditions were there, and he testified this is a contract. There wasn't any question in his mind. It may be above his pay grade what all the minutiae is, but he knew it was there. There's not any dispute on that.
I don't think that an agent can act for all purposes for the principal.
I would agree, Judge, not for all purposes.
I'm seeing a paucity of evidence, including certainly his own testimony, that if he was an agent,
yes, Your Honor,
that he had the power to alter terms and conditions, bind the principal, or change the do any of this stuff.
And I'm not saying that the terms or conditions are anything different than these gentlemen running Crescent knew.
Okay, I didn't mean these terms. I meant in general.
Certainly. I don't think that there's any evidence that these terms and conditions were anything different than Mr. Lack had agreed to on the Acton well a month ahead of time that involved these same appellants. And there was discussion throughout the trial about the Acton well.
But he said he'd only read these terms and conditions two or three times
in
the last 30 years.
Correct, Judge.
You're saying, no, it was on the Acton well that we drilled just before this one?
No, Judge, I'm saying that these are well-known issues that are out there. He knows that they're out there, just like I can sign a contract.
He can know they're out there but not have the authority to bind the principal to them.
And I would say, in response to that, that he had apparent authority or actual authority for the reasons cited in the brief.
How did he have apparent authority to bind the principal to contractual conditions?
He is agreeing that whatever the agreement out there may be as between Basic and Crescent, he knew that there are terms and conditions on the back of the work tickets.
Okay. All right.
Well, in terms of company man.
Yes, Your Honor.
Lack testifies that it was his understanding he was the company man.
Correct.
On the job.
And Mr. Siddiqui testified that Lack was his eyes and ears.
And that he was the person that he instructed Basic people, the people at Basic, to go to for direction on what to do on the job.
Correct.
I know that we see this term company man often on matters involving oil field, gas field.
Yes, Your Honor.
And there's no question about this as terms of what that might have meant to the parties when they were contracting, and the paucity of answers or questions asked the jury. And the answers they gave do not directly deal with that issue.
That's correct, Judge. I think under broad form, it's included in question number one.
So it just falls down to the bottom.
It does, Judge. It does. And again, I don't think the court needs to reach that issue because of the answer to question number two.
If he's the company man, he had authority.
Correct. And Your Honors, I appreciate the additional time, but I will respectfully
thank you for your argument, sir. Counsel, we have rebuttal.
Yes, sir.
couple of factual points I'd like to kind of clear up. First, as you heard some testimony, some mention of the Acton well. The Acton well, the record shows, is another well in which Mr. Siddiqui and pulling were involved, different things. Mr. Lack worked on that well. That well in the testimony is completely different. Number one, it wasn't Basic, this defendant, it was a company called Basin with an IN. Totally different entity, did the work there. On that well, unlike this one, Mr. Lack was engaged to hire everybody that went to work. Say Basic, this Basic, not Basin, worked on Acton. Maybe they could say, well, we're going to treat this like we did the Acton well. But they weren't involved in the rework of the Acton well, so they can't piggyback onto that because it's a completely different legal entity. Mr. Lack testified that his charge on Acton, Mr. Siddiqui testified, was totally different. Much, much, much broader scope than existed on this particular well. And in fact, there's testimony from Mr. Siddiqui, and I believe Mr. Lack, that the one time Mr. Lack went out of bounds and hired somebody that he wanted to hire, Mr. Siddiqui wasn't advised about it, and Mr. Siddiqui said, we're not supposed to be paying you. You're not supposed to be engaging anybody without hiring us. Now, on the company man issue, there's nothing in the record where Mr. Lack said, I went in to Mr. Thomas or anybody else and told them I was the company man. I think Mr. Lack said he may have considered himself the company man or somehow thought that he was the company man. The testimony is that Mr. Thomas, and this is Mr. Thomas's testimony, Mr. Thomas was told by Mr. Siddiqui, Mr. Lack's a consultant. Mr. Thomas testified he made his own assumption without relying on anything else based on the fact that he'd been told Mr. Lack was only a consultant. So that's the same thing as a company man. I'm not aware of any authority, and I understand the court, company man's kind of an odd concept. I'm not sure that I see much difference between that and agency, but
he's asked the very question you're telling us about. Was your role the same on the Crescent well as it had been on the Acton well? Guess what he answered? Yes.
His role, as far as monitoring the well, Your Honor, but not as far as negotiating contracts. And I don't think his testimony is there. If you look at the testimony of Mr. Siddiqui and Mr. Pulling, Mr. Lack was the one on Acton who did everything. All the things that were done with Devon that were already done by other people as a result of the action in the Railroad Commission on Devon's complaint about the water going someplace where it shouldn't be. Now, Basic has said a couple of times, has pointed to the fact that Mr. Siddiqui told people at Devon that Mr. Lack was the go-to guy. There's an important reason for that. If you look at the Rule 11 agreement, which was part of the record, I think it's Plaintiff's Exhibit Number 15, I believe it's paragraph 11 of the Rule 11 agreement specifically mandates that Devon be advised when work was done and Devon be authorized to have people at the well site during the reworking. And the timing of Mr. Siddiqui's emails was right before the work started, which was what would have been required for him to comply with the Rule 11 agreement that had been entered into the Railroad Commission. That information was never disclosed. There's nothing in the record that anyone at Devon ever told anyone. I'm not sure there's anything in the record about whether Devon actually sent somebody to the well. Matter of fact, I know there's nothing in the record about that. I don't know if that's ever been developed. But there's certainly nothing in the record where anybody from Devon ever said, we're here because Mr. Lack is the guy that's going to tell everybody how everything's done and expand his authority. I think if the court goes through the Garcia analysis, there is no apparent authority for Mr. Lack's actions. First off, the principal, that's Mr. Siddiqui, had no knowledge that Mr. Lack was signing the terms and conditions. Mr. Lack's testimony is he never told them that he did that, so that misses one of the requirements that's stated in Garcia and also in this court's Texas City View opinion, which is quoted in our reply brief. So you don't get there. Then you get to the last sentence where the quote from Texas City View says, finally, a party dealing with an agent, which in this case would be Basin, assuming that they want you to find Mr. Lack as the agent, must ascertain both the fact and scope of the agent's authority. And if the party deals with the agent without having made such a determination, she does so at her own risk. Now, that's exactly what Basic did. Mr. Thomas just made an assumption. He doesn't say, I asked Mr. Lack, are you the company man? He didn't testify to that. The only testimony is he was told that Mr. Lack was a consultant. So if BASIC wants to argue apparent authority for agency, under the case that they principally cited, Texas City View, this court has told them that they can't. I think I'm out of time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Ford. Counsel, thank you both for your very helpful oral argument, and your case is submitted, and you're free to go.
Thank you, Your Honor.